Salutations. Welcome to another episode of Rec Room Radio. In this particular episode, we would like to talk about a bit of ethics surrounding military enforcement, recruitment, and the ethical boundaries around the forces that be to some degree. What is going too far and where are the parameters in terms of those ethics? Sometimes, is there a right or justified cause behind even torture that happens in these ranks? And that's a question that some people have pursued and attempted to evaluate in the questionable ethics of such ranks and really trying to illustrate this picture to the larger public. There's been articles written by a guest that has decided to join us today, who is an individual and an ex-militant who has written two articles, I believe one or two articles about the subject matter that we're going to be getting into depth today. But I'd like him to introduce himself along with Solar.
Yeah, it's good to be back on our episode. Thank you, Damian. It's good to have you on our show. And it's good to see someone else with prior military service on as well. Always enjoy speaking to vets. How are you doing?
Yeah, no, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate you inviting me on here. It's good to, it's always good to talk about these sort of things, even if the subject matter might be a bit uncomfortable.
For those unaware about your service, how long were you in the military and what drew you to write about what we're going to be discussing at length today?
Yeah, so I was in the Australian Army for 5 years. I was in infantry. I really enjoyed my time. The reason why I've written about torture resistance training was because I personally went through it and it had a pretty profound impact on me. It left me with PTSD and major depressive disorder. And after doing research and seeing other people going through this course and speaking out about, how this sort of training profoundly impacted them and leading to similar sort of psychological illnesses with them as well, I decided that it was important to speak out a little bit more about what's actually happening in Australia and maybe ways that we can improve it.
And what necessarily caused you to start this instead of just being an advocate, because you are currently the founder of Conduct After Capture? What made you want to start a whole organization? Why not just write articles for it?
Yeah, so I'm the president of Reform CAC. So Reform CAC is an organization that wants to try to change this course. The reason why I decided to found the organization rather than just write an article is because, as we've probably seen quite a lot, is that writing an article does, bugger all. it doesn't really do all that much. And if we want to actually try to get things done and actually make changes, just merely writing an article about it's not going to be enough. You need to have an organization that's actually going to think about the strategy and actually do lobbying and advocacy work to try and actually get something changed. And it also provides a foundation for other members to actually come and use their resources or to show their support for that organization as well.
So what I'm getting from that is, not only with writing an article, it definitely helps inform people by having someone with intimate knowledge of what people have gone through and why exactly it is an issue. But with having that group, it allows people to not only have a group they can point to that is actively informing and basically proliferating the message while having this baseline as an insightful way to be informed about the dilemma and problems that often plaguing a lot of these soldiers, correct?
Oh yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, I know that after creating this foundation, quite a few people reached out to me and contacted me asking me about how I could support them or how they could support me. And I think it's important as just sort of like a meeting ground that everyone can sort of understand how it is that we can push, our message forward and how we can actually make real change.
I know a lot of different military organizations across the world have their own versions of interrogation training. So I know for when I was in the service, we had SEER, which was Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, where they would teach you a lot of the interrogation methods and like what happens if you're being caught, how not to break and stuff. What would you say made the Australian military's interrogation classes and stuff like of the sort particularly that enough for you where you thought like, this is too much, you know, this is like almost barbaric?
Yeah, so our training is actually quite different from both the American version and the UK version, and also the Canadian version as well. So in many of these, so especially in the American SEER courses, the interrogation part is actually just one part of a much larger module. So it obviously includes things like actually escaping, actually, you know, they'll actually teach you survival skills when you've actually escaped so you can live off the land and do other things like that. With the Australian course, it's not like that. It's only the interrogation stuff. So they're only focusing on the counter-interrogation elements. So you're not supposed to escape. You're not supposed to evade. You're not supposed to learn how to survive. It's basically just the interrogation. And the aspects of it that make it so heinous is that they use, obviously, I think they use sleep deprivation, all of the different sort of counter-interrogation courses around the world. But they use specifically sexual violence, sexual assault, actual torture techniques on soldiers for extended periods of time. You know, these courses can go up to 96 hours, and so you're having to deal for 96 hours with some of these techniques. It can be extremely brutal, and especially when it comes to sleep deprivation. You know, there are plenty of meta studies out there that show that sleep deprivation after 72 hours produces symptoms akin to acute psychosis. And so when you're in such a vulnerable psychological state, having to go through a lot of these different interrogation methods, it basically becomes an accumulative effect of, you know, just bad on top of bad. And so I'm not aware of the brief research that I've done into the SEER course, into the UK course, and the Canadian course, that they go so extreme and so far as the Australian course does.
Yeah, and a lot of the SEER course, what makes it a lot easier for people is that it's in three different degrees or stages. So first one's more of an intro, second one is you being qualified for it, third one is you are able to conduct and teach others these methods, like if you want to be an instructor. And a lot of that could go on, like we were talking about, sleep deprivation, getting hit by, you know, cold water in the middle of the night, being stripped to just your bare underwear, put in like really cramped, uncomfortable areas. But all of that being said, that's only for like nearly the final stage almost, where it's like these are things only instructors go through because they have to do it a little bit above and beyond. So they know they're capable of taking these things. So when they dish it out to soldiers, when we're teaching them, it's within fairness, as in, you know, do not ask your soldier something that you yourself cannot do mentality. So that's why it's very rare and very few to have it. And I know, especially in America, the United States military, there are some controversies around the third stage of SEERs.
Yeah, I also heard that when it comes to the SEER course, that they actually try to encourage people to actually go to sleep at certain times, because they actually say, look, you know, I'm pretty sure I heard an American or a Marine officer basically say that, well, you know, it's pretty difficult to actually get information out of people if they're completely tired. You know, they're just going to be a bumbling mess. You need to sometimes you know, going to sleep can also be sort of an interrogation method as well. So yeah, so they actually do sometimes encourage actually sleeping on the SEER course, as opposed to the Australian course, where you're sleep deprived from the very get-go to the very end. There is no sleeping whatsoever.
And question for the course in Australia, do you guys also have different tiers for it, or is it just one big course?
Yeah, we do have different tiers. So we have level A, level B, and level C. So level A is just like an online module that you'll do. It's like, you know, a tick and flick sort of like, you know, if you've ever, you know, gone to university, you've done one of those like introduction sort of courses where you basically just have to do a questionnaire online. It's something kind of similar to that. Level B is more in depth. It involves like a, you know, an actual presentation, but you're not actually doing anything. You're not actually doing anything physical. It's still just sort of an educational sort of environment. And level C is where they actually put you through the specific sort of situations or scenarios where you would actually be captured by different enemy personnel. So the, you know, one stage would be the a terrorist organization. Another one would be a foreign government organization. So that would be like their police or their intelligence agencies. And then the third one is like being captured by a foreign military. And that last one is usually the longest one.
So rather than this being a punishment, this is usually due to build up some fortitude if you're ever in those circumstances.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's meant to, well, first of all, I'd imagine that it's meant, the purpose behind it is to try and build up some resilience, but it's also meant to be actually doing training techniques. It's meant to be training certain techniques for if you are engaged. I don't want to be too specific because in Australia, this is still a very classified sort of course, and I don't want to go into too much depth about specifically what we're being trained in. But basically, if we see a particular technique used by the interrogators or whatever, we're trained to respond in a certain way. And so basically, the purpose of going through these in-depth scenarios and situational training is so that you're basically given a live experience of certain situations where these sort of techniques might be used by a foreign, you know, enemy force, and you have to respond in the way that you were trained.
And I guess my question to you would be, not to sound callous, but would you want to encourage more? How drastic of a reform are we talking about? Because I've always seen programs like for the United States military, like Sears, for example, to be a necessary evil, if you will, where it's not a pleasant thing to do, but we do have to have some soldiers qualified in this to be able to teach these things, or for people who are prepared. Because what would be worse is if an enemy combatant gets a hold of you, and next thing you know, you're going through intense pain, interrogation, and torture, and you don't know how to respond, and because of that, now your platoon is dead because you gave away your location. What would you in particular want to reform in regards to it, and how far or how much do you want to do?
Yeah, so this is a great question, and I 100% agree that we need to have courses like this. Absolutely, like there are some soldiers out there who have gone through this course that just want it completely gone. They think that there is that the course is just so bad as it is at the moment that it should just be eliminated. That is absolutely not my position. My position is that there is a genuine capability that's needed by courses like this, and you described that capability very, very succinctly with basically saying, well, we need to be taught how to resist certain interrogation techniques. But my reforms are basically to try to get rid of the most harmful aspects of this course that actually don't contribute to good training but seem just to create injury. So there are three main reforms that I want made to the course itself, and then there are three other policies that our organization is trying to make to help those who've already gone through this course. So the first policy is to stop all the interrogation exploitation techniques on the course that could cause trauma or moral injury. Now there's plenty of studies, especially in Australia, that go into, you know, the effects of moral injury. And I know that in America, moral injury is a very deep concern for quite a lot of psychologists, because, you know, there's quite a lot of people who have been made redundant or have had to medically discharge from United States service because of moral injury. You know, they felt like they were forced to do things that were completely against their conscience or what they believed. And there are certain techniques being used on this course that do cause trauma and moral injury, and I'm sure we can get into specifically what those are. The second one is that the monitoring psychologists on the Conduct After Capture Level C course be chosen by the Australian Psychological Society, and that these psychologists should be able to withdraw participants anonymously. So one of the main sort of problems that that was actually raised by people who were interested in my program, there have been other whistleblowers of this course before me, and one of these was a guy called Dr. Stephen Scully, who was actually a medical support officer for this training. And when he was seeing what was going on, he was actually shocked, and he felt that, you know, some of the most disgusting sort of elements of this course were things that he couldn't really do. He couldn't really do much about, because mainly because he was still he still had to answer to the military hierarchy, and you have to be pretty brave to go against a superior officer in the army. It's definitely not something that you do, and obviously there can be some pretty severe punishments for questioning the orders of a superior officer. You know, you could be you know, charged with insubordination. You know, they may, you know, put a pause or freeze on your career progress. And also, it's very much against the ethos of the military to question the hierarchy. You're basically, if you're given an order, you kind of just do it sort of mentality. And, you know, maybe there's something to be said about, you know, whether that's actually a good mentality to have or not. I think to a certain extent, that's definitely a good mentality. But this doctor, Dr. Stephen Scully, basically said that support staff are unlikely to intervene in the course because they're still subject to the military hierarchy. And we actually had a Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide here in Australia that found that one of the person who was representing Defence found that no one, not during his entire time running this course, has anyone intervened because of any of the tactics or techniques that were being done. Any of the techniques being done during this course. So the purpose of this particular policy is to try to bring a bit more accountability to, or try to give a bit more freedom to support staff to actually be able to intervene if they think things are going too far. Because it seems that when, you know, we're talking about, you know, sexual violence being used on this course and literal torture or, you know, and I don't use the word torture lightly. These are techniques that have been been deemed by, you know, the United Kingdom Supreme Court, by the United Nations, by the European Union, by the government of Ireland. You know, these are techniques that, you know, very major, you know, that, you know, very, very high ranking, you know, authorities are basically saying that these techniques are torture. That's the main reason for why we think that there needs to be a bit more independence and freedom when it comes to support staff, when it comes to actually monitoring this course. And then the third one is just limiting sleep deprivation on the course to 48 hours. And this is just so that our course is in line with what's being done in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom do not do sleep deprivation past 48 hours. And from what I read, the United States sort of SIRA training does also limit the sleep deprivation. We do not limit the sleep deprivation on our course, and I think that that's extremely detrimental. So those are the three sort of reforms that I want done to the conduct after capture training. And then the only three other policies which are trying to help veterans is that mental health claims submitted to the Department of Veteran Affairs for anyone who is participating on this course should just be de facto accepted. Obviously, if this course is causing trauma or moral injury, and this is causing, you know, mental health claims, that these mental health claims should just be de facto accepted if someone's gone on this course. There are plenty of instances where people have submitted mental health claims to DVA after going on this course, and they've been rejected because that DVA doesn't think that you can actually get traumatized by this course, and that's completely ridiculous. The second one is that the specific torture techniques that are being done on this course should be made illegal and nationally recognized as a form of torture. I think that this will help a lot of soldiers realize that what was actually done to them was wrong. That there is a bit of reconciliation there for a lot of soldiers. They can actually grasp and understand that what happened to them was wrong, and so they can actually feel a little bit at ease at you know, the uncertainty of, was what happened to me right or wrong? You know, I'm not sure. And then the third one is just that the government make an official apology about how it's treated soldiers during this course. So those are the six sort of reforms that I'm seeing to make. Three are actually to the course. Three are just to help soldiers who have done the course.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is exceptionally fair, considering that while America, we have our survival, evasion, resistance, and escape, and I do understand the necessary evil that is a byproduct of getting people prepared to be in circumstances where they'll be tortured to confess and comply and forfeit vital information that would put their other allies in danger for the most part. One of the particular things I thought was interesting is with torture, fundamentally speaking, in some regards, regardless of the level of training to the person or the individual in question, most of this, to some regard, is to not break the person just physically, because physical endurance is just a part of the curriculum when it comes to military operations. What is vital for torture to be effective is to mentally break the person, to put them in a sort of permanent mental anguish where, rather than dealing with anything coming forward, the forfeit of information is more advantageous. It comes to my attention, like people such as David J. Morris, who discussed at length about waterboarding, where he talked about being stripped naked, how he had gotten hypothermia, how he had to deal with the cold environment, and not just the mental fortitude that it would take, but the time frame in which it happened would and especially how elongated that would probably create a permanent vestige in his mind where it would kind of plague him beyond just that simple period of time in which he had to deal with those torturous instances where he was hooded, beaded, starved, and stripped naked during December of all times.
Yeah, I mean, I guess something that I would say to that is that I think that there are ways to build resilience without actually having to put people through torture. So, for example, I mean, I think that just any sort of hardship builds sort of mental fortitude. I mean, if anyone who's gone through the army knows that there is a lot of hardships that are purposely imposed upon us in order to try and build mental resilience. And I think that like doing that, those sort of techniques are is completely sufficient in order to train mental resilience to torture techniques. The problem that I think happens when it comes to actually utilizing and doing torture techniques in courses like this is that there is the unnecessary risk of actually causing trauma, which completely undermines resilience. Because, you know, hardship is what actually builds resilience, but trauma, it actually completely undermines it. You can't, you can't make trauma only produces injury. And so the argument that I think needs to be on everyone's mind when we're talking about these sort of issues is that we wouldn't want any course that purposely injures soldiers. You know, injury might be a you know, unnecessary sort of consequence of some forms of training, but it shouldn't be something that's intentionally done, or there shouldn't be actions that are intentionally done that cause injury. Like, we would be shocked if we heard that, you know, in the special forces, soldiers were being purposely, sh were actually being shot in the shoulder in order to build resilience. That would just be stupid. And I think it's the exact same thing when it comes to torture techniques. Torture techniques purpose are intrinsically used to inflict trauma. And the exact same thing when it comes to techniques that in, that you know yeah techniques that utilize moral injury. Moral injury is also only used to inflict trauma. And trauma is not something that we should be, you know, instilling in our soldiers. We should be instilling hardship. We should be instilling resilience. But trauma is not something that we should be instilling. And I think that there is a fine, you know, line, you know, of demarcation between hardship, you know, which is good and actually helps us build resilience, and trauma, which only produces injury and, you know, leads to things like PTSD or depression or anxiety and a lot of other things that actually leave soldiers redundant. You know, mean that they can't actually function anymore within the army. We want soldiers that are actually going to be able to function well within the army, and we need resilient soldiers. So we need to know what the fine line is between, you know, training which produces training which is, you know, hard and, you know, builds resilience, and training that which is just actually just going to cause injury and is not necessary.
What I like about that too is it makes a pretty clear distinction that, look, we're not trying to make any soldiers weak in the sense that, hey, this is what's going to happen in combat. But it also addresses the unnecessary measures taken of like maiming or committing bodily harm or physical injury. Because I'm in full agreement with you, like it becomes illogical to like maim a soldier to a point where you could call it physical permanent disfigurement or even temporary for a long period of time. That just isn't productive to a well cohesive fighting unit when you're making your guys weak. And that's something a lot of people on the outside may not understand or consider fully, but for any veterans listening in, you know what I'm talking about with that, because that's one thing they always preach about a lot. You know, make sure you have a cohesive fighting unit, make sure everyone's green across the board. We can get our soldiers out in a snap. So that's something I definitely to consider about as well.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I think that actually having your own soldiers inflict traumatic techniques on you probably has some pretty unintended side effects when it comes to the cohesion with the rest of your army. I mean, if you feel like your army has treated you in a way where you were actually traumatized by techniques that they inflicted upon you, I think that almost in there is an argument to be made that that actually could be used by enemy forces to basically make you talk. Because, like, for example, the only thing they need to say is, like, oh, well, we're not going to traumatize you. We're not going to put you through torture techniques like your own army did. You know, we're a much better soldier. You know, it's like that whole, like, good cop, bad cop, where your own army or your own military is the bad cop. Like, I think there are no studies to suggest this. I haven't seen any studies that suggest that this is an actual effect of this training. But I think there is a logic behind it to say that, well, maybe this sort of training is actually going to make you less cohesive with your own army.
I mean, what you just described is what the United States military did in the early 2010s and forward for the Middle East, where it became less of a game of us versus ISIS, Al Qaeda, or Taliban, and more of a game of us winning the people over. You don't win people over by putting a, you know, rifle down their throat. You win them over by saying, like, hey, you don't have to worry about us. Wasn't it, you know, ISIS, Taliban, and these groups that chopped off your daughter's head the other day? Wasn't it them who burned down your village? Wasn't it them who caused you grievous harm? That's how you win people over, especially in a unit. And even, funny enough, you mentioned that the Coast Guard in the United States does that all the time with any cartel members, where they know the cartel's reputation of what they do to people who get captured and brought back. It's better you just don't come back alive. So they're like, look, man, you're either going to talk to us and we're going to help you, or you're going to get let back with them and then they're going to do worse to you than anything we could legally do on any book. So that's something where it could definitely have a strong negative side effect on the morale of the unit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What's up, Hazy?
And just bringing this up, I think what you were speaking about in terms of negotiating and talking to people, I think it's very interesting that they ensure that torture is just not used often enough, because it feels like the same oppression, but in a different suit, which wouldn't lead to any sort of productive healing for the environment, no matter which one we're offshore guarding against or trying to make salvageable and permanent change to. Especially when we think about, like, the Geneva Convention and the considerable amount of efforts they put forward to ensure that there was no mental or physical harm or other forms of coercion, though it is understand that some people might go beyond, above and beyond to do such things of that nature. At least there is some confine that we use to hold these people accountable, because once again, to reiterate, it's literally causing permanent mental anguish to individuals for this to have occurred, especially when we look back at things like the Korean War and how they didn't adhere to these things, or using these training regiments on our own soldiers and how unethical that was. So suffice it to say, it's important to understand the functionality of torture, and if we were ever to implement it, then there needs to be a hard line as to what are the do's and don'ts, because fundamentally we are irreparably damaging people when they're done the service, when everything's all said and done.
Yeah, and I mean, I know that America has a different take when it comes to the different international agreements that they've signed up to. But from the Australian perspective, we've signed up to things like the Convention Against Torture. We've signed up to things like the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights. We've signed up to, you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We've signed up to a lot of these, you know, international agreements that explicitly prohibit torture and explicitly prohibit the use of torture. I think that we're actually neglecting our international obligations as a country in Australia when we're inflicting torture on our own soldiers. Now, I know that there is an argument, and I've heard the argument made that, well, people can, voluntarily, get out of the training, you know, they can withdraw from the training. There's another argument to say, well, you know, this is just a simulation in some way. But if you've actually gone through the training, you realize this is not a simulation. You're actually getting tortured. You're actually going through this, you know, these instances of sexual violence and all these other sort of things. And also the idea of willingly being able to withdraw is just throwing the obligation onto the other person. Like, it's basically saying, well, the obligation to not torture people lies on the victim of the torture and not the perpetrator of the torture. Like, nowhere would anyone accept that justification. Like, that's it's really up to the victim to prevent torture rather than the perpetrator. And then the other point is, you know, after you've been sleep deprived for 72 hours and you're in that state of acute psychosis where you're detached from reality, you have visual and auditory hallucinations, you're basically like many people would probably not even think, realize that they're in a course anymore. They think what's happening to them is really actually happening to them. Well, how are they supposed to withdraw if they think what's happening to them is actually happening and they're not part of a course anymore? It's just completely unthinkable that the Australian government continually tries to deny that this sort of stuff is happening, or at least not affirm or deny what's actually going on. But then, you know, they're completely neglecting their obligations to a lot of these international treaties that they've signed up to. And I think that they've got a lot to answer for when it comes to, you know, condemning other countries for using torture, but then actually doing it themselves. I mean, it's not going to be a very effective foreign affairs policy if, you know, you're condemning others for what you're doing yourself.
Thank you for that, Damian. I'd like to move forward and talk about your first article, but before I do so, is there anything you'd like to mention to us before we get into this at all, or anything you want the audience to know up at this point?
No, we can get into it.
All right, sounds good. So today we're going to be discussing, particularly in this article by Damian DePyle, yours truly, and he was shedding some light on the conduct after capture courses in the Australian Army. We've already been discussing it up to this point, but a lot of his article does raise important concerns about the course and suggest that, you know, it, like we've been saying earlier, it causes great bodily harm. And he also, in his article, highlights a lot of testimonies, such as soldiers who experience, you know, allegations of sexual assault, trauma-induced techniques, and questionable practice. And we are also going to be discussing further a lot of the implications, so a lot of what we've been already discussing now. I'm looking forward to getting into this. Damian, I've read your article earlier, and I actually had a question I wanted to ask you on it.
Go ahead.
First one, you mentioned a character, his name's Stuart Bonner, an SAS hero. Could you elaborate a little bit more on why he was so relevant in your article, and why he was an important pivoting point for you in writing this?
Yeah, sure. So, obviously, after I went through this training and I was subject to a lot of this stuff, I was trying to find information of any other Australian soldier that has gone through this. And Stuart Bonner, the SAS hero that went through this training, actually wrote a book. It's actually a pretty good book. It's called Redback One. And I think it's written by Robert... let me see. I've got it on my bookshelf. It's written by Robert McKillen. And it actually goes through, it actually describes in detail exactly what happened to him. Now, Robert McKillen, who's the guy who's writing this book of Stuart Bonner, talks about how he feels like it's morally outrageous that, you know, soldiers have been going through this. And Stuart Bonner himself even details events that basically seem exactly the kind of description you would make of waterboarding and other sort of water torture techniques that is pretty graphic. But he's a figure that is widely respected. He's not some, you know, person who is, you know, has some grievances against the army, or, you know, is just doing this for some personal gain, or, you know, talking about this course for some personal gain. He's very heavily respected. He's widely regarded as a hero. He's served in many, many wars. And even he himself, in this book, is talking about the ramifications of this course. He's saying, you know, that there may be serious health ramifications from some of the techniques that were used in this course. And this is the same kind of guy that's been overseas, who has obviously seen the horrors of war. He's gone through, you know, some of the most grueling training that the Australian government can put you through. And out of all of the training, this is the one piece of training that he singles out as saying that this may have serious health ramifications, that he feels like this course is what planted the seeds that led to him developing PTSD. He thought that this was the origin, not, you know, the events overseas in, you know, the wars or anything like that. It was this course that he went through. So I think that this is an extremely powerful testimony by a very, very well-respected figure who is claiming, very similar to what I'm claiming, that there are serious health ramifications from this course and the techniques that are used.
And what I like about this character as well and his testimony is that this isn't some pushover. This isn't some, you know, PFC who joins and then feels like it's not meant for him, then leaves. This is actually a well-decorated soldier who's went through, I would say, hell and back, and he's earned a right to say that. So I find that interesting, especially with him and his credential going through all these courses, saying like this one in particular is the one that does the most damage. That'd be equivalent for Americans if like we had a David Goggins, if you will, and he said, I went through SEAL training, I went through, you know, MARSAC, I went through Ranger training, but this one particular training right here is what messed me up a lot. It's like shouldn't be around. So I'm glad you actually included that. That one was a really good eye catcher during the article.
Yeah, well, thanks for bringing it up. Yeah, I think that he has a lot to say about this, and he was one of the first. I don't think he really blew the whistle on the course, but he definitely alerted people to the, you know, the particular, you know, cruelty of this course.
Definitely. And my next question is going to be a bit tough for you, so please take your time on this if it need be. But as we've been alluding to earlier throughout this podcast, there has been a lot of mentions of sexual assault and other sexual perversive scenarios that occurred a lot during the course. But for you, I want to know, do you have any reports that support these claims, or has there been any notable investigations into these allegations right now that's either in media that has been catching the eyes of like any government officials, anything that's like really big scale for you guys?
Yeah, so there are some limitations about what I can say, because the events around this course are currently being suppressed by the government in a federal court case. I'd imagine a federal court case for the equivalent in America would be like a Supreme Court case. Is Supreme Court like your second highest court ranking behind? I think you guys have like a... Oh, no, Supreme Court's the highest ranking for you. What would be like the second highest ranking?
I'm blanking on that right now. Hazy, what's our second highest court ranking?
Because Supreme Court's the highest for you, isn't it?
No. Yeah, the Supreme Court's the highest. I know it's like state level, then there's federal. I'll get back to you on that, because now you just told me in a moment. I kind of blanked on that. Apologies.
Yeah, that's right. But yeah, it would be... So I'm personally suing the government for what happened to me. And so the specific details about confirmation of certain events or what have you is currently being suppressed, but there is media testimony to that details some of the events that have happened to other soldiers, and I'll explain what the media is also what is reported about me, because I also have to be careful about what I say about my own events, because there are certain parts of the events that are also suppressed for my stuff. But so, for example, the first person who really spoke up about the sexual harassment was a soldier called Evan Donaldson. And he basically spoke about, you know, that he was tortured and all that sort of stuff, but he was purposely sexually assaulted in a way where he got anal tears. And you know, there's very few ways that you can get anal tears without, you know, certain things happening. But you know, and he discusses how basically blood was just coming out all the time. You know, he was having to try and patch it up with toilet paper. You know, it's pretty full on, and his story goes even further. You know, there are quite a few articles that go into how the government tried to cover up what happened to him, that they purposely altered documents around his employment with the Australian Defence Force, and even one of our government ombudsmen basically looked into it and they said, yeah, this actually happened. So there are actual confirmed reports about the government covering up about what's happening on this course by our own government ombudsman. There's also the Royal Commission in Defence of Veteran Suicide, who is taking a keen interest into this course. And they've found some pretty startling sort of... figures about this course, where people who go through this course are 38 times more likely to commit suicide than the general population, and 15 times more likely than the veteran population. Those are astronomical numbers. Like, it's crazy to think that, you know, the numbers are really that high when it comes to just people who are going through this course, including 15 times higher than the veteran population. But when it comes to the sexual side of things, there was a Freedom of Information Act put forward by a journalist called Craig Dunlop from one of our newspapers called the Herald Sun, And this Freedom of Information Act confirms the use of sex toys, homosexual porn, dog collars, and Bibles and Qurans, dog leashes, like, you know. And the Freedom of Information Act actually found that it seems like that the government is also covering up the use of these items as well, because none of these items are actually bought with government funds, but are bought by the trainers and then donated to this course. But yeah, there is confirmation of sex toys, homosexual porn, and other sort of items being used on this course by Craig Dunlop. And then obviously what happened with me, it's widely reported that, you know, I was forced to stimulate sexual intercourse with a doll with a dildo. You know, I was given a dildo, told to put it between my legs, and forced to basically rape this doll, which they told me was to represent my sister. I was, you know, had lots of disparaging comments about me being a Catholic and that, you know, I must enjoy raping kids and, you know, I must be a pedophile and I support pedophiles. There's also, you know, I was told to use this dildo to simulate ejaculating onto the Bible. You know, there's some pretty like disgusting and sadistic crap. So, you know, there are media reports which, you know, obviously aren't always confirmable. There is the Royal Commission sort of stuff that's going in. There's obviously the Freedom of Information Acts that are confirming certain aspects of what's going on in this course. And also, there is the federal government, the federal court case going on at the moment to release certain suppressed documents. And I'd imagine that the more of these documents that get released, the more details may be confirmed or denied by the government. I can't say one way or another because obviously they are suppressed. But you know, if the one of our media organizations is trying to get these documents suppressed, so we'll see what happens after that.
All right, and before we go over to Hazy, I want to let you know if there's any questions I ask you that are beyond the bounds of you answering, feel free to just let us know. We can move on to a separate question because I wouldn't want to get you in trouble at all. But hey, thanks again for sharing all that. It's not an easy thing to do, I assume.
Oh, well, yeah, I don't really like bringing up exactly what happened to me because it kind of brings everything back, but it's important to this information gets out there so that people are aware of what's going on and that people feel motivated to actually try to also believe that this course needs to be changed.
In me, one of the possibly most absurd things of this nature, especially when taking into account the torture that people were going through, is not only with the sexual aspect of it all, but the coping mechanisms that they described in contrast. Telling them to think of every song they've ever heard of the last 4 years and try to sing it to help them with the environment. If that would ever ameliorate or remedy asking people to do such insidious and deplorable acts such as the ones you're describing. Especially with knowing that at least 45 people killed themselves as a byproduct of this type of training. I can't imagine what sort of psychological trauma that would have put onto a person, and just offering that as a coping mechanism in contrast to what we're talking about seems inadequate in regards I could not articulate.
Yeah, just to correct you, only so 45 people died through all three of those courses. So I explained that there was level A, level B, and level C. So 45 people committed suicide after all three of those ones. But like most people do like the first level. So but they specifically said that only five people committed suicide after the specific training that I'm trying to get reformed. But if you look at that in comparison to the amount of people that have probably actually gone through this training, we believe that our organization believes that that's around only 1,100 people have actually gone through this particular form of training. But five people out of 1,100 people is actually like pretty big numbers because, that basically means that we have a suicide rate of 454.55 per 100,000. And 454.55 per 100,000, that's in comparison to Australia's national suicide rate, which is 12. So 454 compared to 12. And the veteran suicide rate is 31. So that's 455 to 31. So it's still a very, very high number in comparison to the averages. But just to say, it wasn't 45 that died specifically of the level C training. It was only 5. It would probably be in my benefit to try to up the numbers, but I just want to be honest with you guys. It wasn't 45. It was only 5.
No. That was completely on my fault for misquoting the article I was discussing at length. But thank you for the correction. Solar?
Yeah, you mentioned earlier an organization for the Royal Commission into Defense and Veteran Suicides findings in regards to the CAC course. Could you explain how a lot more of these courses are linked in particular to the suicide rates among participants? A little bit more what we've already been talking about now. Do you think there's anything else we should add on to that? To think, like, why else were soldiers doing this besides, like, the training? Has there been, like, accounts of, like, you know, severe afterbirth stuff as well?
Yeah, so there hasn't been any definitive reports by the Royal Commission Defense of Veteran Suicide, but there have been hearings. And so the hearings have been done. So, for example, the one public hearing that we have, on record is the hearing of Colonel Simon Dowse, who was basically a pretty instrumental person into the formation and running of this course for a very long period of time. He basically brings up that during this hearing, we find that, for example, there has been no independent studies as to the effectiveness of this training, the adverse effects of the training that it has on trainees, the adverse effects that this training has on instructors, the balance of effectiveness of the training to the adverse effects, or the effectiveness of the debriefing by an instructor that played a role of an adversary. So basically what that says is that there have been no independent studies around the course and, you know, how it may contribute to suicide or it can have any sort of negative effects. And I think that that's pretty significant that there has been, like, there has been a huge amount of condemnations, like complaints about this course have come up since 2005. So that's almost 20 years ago. There have been complaints about this course, and over those 20 years since these complaints started, there have been no independent investigations into this course as to whether it's even effective or not. There's also significant problems when it comes to some of the other things that were brought up in this hearing. So, for example, it was found out that the observers have never intervened on this course to stop, like, the sexual violence or anything like that. He even mentions that, you know, people on this course have been basically forced to do this course as part of their training for particular roles in the army. And also the willingness for participants to withdraw, because I mean, there's a pretty big mentality of people who go through the army that you don't want to be seen as like a I don't know what the American term would be for it, but it basically like a someone who basically pretends to feign injuries or someone that looks like they're weak or that can't get through, you know, tough training. Like, you want to be seen as being, like, you know, very, very resilient. You want to be seen as being able to get through this pretty tough training. And so there is quite a lot of cultural aspects to going through this training where you're not going to withdraw, even if they're doing things that kind of cross a line.
Understand that too, what you're being about the cultural aspect, because especially in the United States military, I guess the term we like to refer to them as is shitbags. So someone who,
yeah,
walking around like, yeah, it's a shitbag over there, like, avoid him, you don't want to be around him. And it creates almost like an ostracization of that one soldier in a platoon or even in like a company or unit. That could be very devastating. And it's unfortunate because I did work in military law, and it was very common for us to have a first sergeant or a commander come in saying, hey, I want this guy out of my unit now. He's being a detriment to our unit because the entire unit wants to basically break his teeth in, to put it politely. And unfortunately, that's the reality of a lot of things, where if you have a soldier who's not doing his job, he will be ostracized. So I know even as early as basic training, what they did for us in basic training was that once you complete 3 stages called the hammer, the anvil, and the forge, which was like ruck marches and other activities that are like supposed to be extremely grueling on you and like taxing on your like sleep and your body, they would line up soldiers who made it all the way and get them in a formation, and they'll put a separate line of soldiers in the corner staying at parade for us, looking upon all the our soldiers as they get their handshake in. They're considered actual soldiers. While the ones who are on the side, like, you know, you'll have a drill sergeant chewing them out, being like, well, you didn't make it. You didn't make the cut. You're not a real soldier. Like, do you want to just go home now? And they're like, you know, talk smack to you, basically. But I definitely understand what you mean by the ostracization effect, because any system that has a very strong hierarchy structure in it is going to push heavy on doing that to a group of soldiers or a group of people if you have power over them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's... and also, like, I even me talk, because there were other people in my unit that did this course as well. And one of the people didn't go through the other end. They pulled out halfway through the course. And, you know, even to today, he has a tremendous amount of shame for pulling out. And this is, you know, this was happened back in 2019. You know, this is like, you know, 5 years ago. And even now, even to this day, 5 years later, he still has a lot of shame from pulling out of this course. And like, he was telling me about specifically what happened to him, like, you know, the five techniques that are the torture techniques I'm talking about. One of them is that you put like white noise on repeat for, you know, extended periods of time, like things like babies crying and, you know, that kind of, you know, pretty, you know, not nice stuff to listen to. And he, you know, he was telling me that, like, in order to try and get his mind off, you know, the babies crying, he was digging his, you know, his cuffs into his hand to try and, you know, basically cause pain to try and get his mind off these noises that were going on. He still has a scar there to this day from, you know, from that course. But even still, he pulled out. And he still has a tremendous amount of shame around that. And, you know, no soldier wants to feel like they failed. Like, that's goes completely against our ethos. And so the idea that, you know, soldiers can voluntarily pull out of this course is laughable, because there are cultural factors that prevent that. There are, like, physiological factors that prevent that with the amount of sleep deprivation. Like, there are just so many factors that go into this idea that you can just voluntarily pull out of this course. That just makes it, like, nonsensical. Like, people are just going to go through this training no matter what you throw it at them, because of these cultural sort of incentives to remain in the course and to finish it, see it to the end.
And I'd say the only positive I've been seeing in recent culture in regards to military stuff is that, not for all courses, but for some courses, let's say Ranger School. Ranger School in the United States military is a very rigorous and hardcore course, where you're constantly having an instructor in your face, like, telling you what's up about it. And throughout it, like, especially when you're at your lowest, they'll tell you, like, hey, if you want to quit right now, door's over there, you can walk out. And it's open forever for, like, anyone. And yes, that has a lot of participants leaving it, but thankfully, a cultural part is that it's not seen as much as shameful, because it's seen as a soldier going above and beyond and trying to do what's more than required of him. I can't say the same for some courses that have, like, a very tight-knit community. So, like, sniper school, basically, in the United States military. We had a service member, I'm not going to say his name, but kill himself around 2021 because he ended up failing sniper school on the final day. And because of that, he just straight-on spiraled. His whole career went down a drain, all because he missed one target, and then that eventually led to a suicide, and no one was there to help him, really. So I was actually going to ask you that. Do you feel for the graduates of these courses, or even the reputation of this course is known as being a very tight-knit community for the people who make it through, you think that could have a role to play in as well, why it's seen as shameful for people to, like, give up above, like, you know, just being an ethos thing?
Specifically around this course, I understand what you mean about, like, the tight-knit sort of community thing. Specifically around this course, I don't think so. This course is used when it comes to SAS training, but obviously they're doing a lot of other training that also lead as well as this course, and obviously they've got a very, very tight-knit community from having done some training with them. People who go through this course, people are coming from all different kinds of units, and they rarely talk with each other afterwards. And even still, like, there is kind of a culture of not even discussing what even happens on this course with others. So it's very difficult to bond with other people who have done this course when you're kind of told, don't even talk about this course outside of this course. I don't think that this course really builds that sort of cohesion, simply because of the nature of of, you know, how people enter this course and, you know, what happens to people after this course and what people's attitudes towards this course after they leave this course as well. So I can understand that with that being done with other courses, and I definitely have felt like that when it comes
school,
to...
For example, or do you have an equivalent for airborne school and Australian military?
We don't have an airborne unit in Australia. We did, but we it was too expensive. But there are courses like that. Like, I'd say infantry training is definitely like that, where you definitely feel like part of a, you know, a good group of brothers after you do your infantry training, or even just things like I'd imagine deployments are also the same as that as well. Like, if you deploy with a certain group of people, you form a pretty cohesive bond with them afterwards. So there are certain forms of training that definitely build that sort of bondship, but I don't think that this course particularly does that.
From what you're describing, it makes tons of sense that it wouldn't make that bond. It's not like, I brought up airborne school because that's a very big deal for a lot of the United States, like, you know, military soldiers, because that shows us that you're able to actually, you know, do something that a majority of the military are not able to do. And it's seen as being more of an admirable thing, or you being like more of a poster boy at the military. So I just trying to see the correlation there, but it makes sense that you're saying like there's not really one for the school you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, there we do have, like, within infantry training, we have specialization courses. And I'd imagine, like some of the more significant ones, like recon and snipers, that I think that there is definitely that sort of attitude of, you know, making it more cohesive, or, you know, having a greater cohesion up for those people who have been able to finish that course. But yeah, I understand what you mean, but I don't think that applies to the conduct after capture course.
Definitely. And I wanted to share a quote from one of the articles you shared as well, the ones done by greenleft.org. And it says here, you know, this is an anonymous quote: "Dealing with the PTSD and depression over 20 years since this course has seriously damaged my marriage, family life, career, earning capacity, and general health and well-being. Had I known what it entailed, I would have never consented to such activity." That... it's just heartbreaking seeing that, because especially for the military, where you're a group of guys who join with this imagery of you defending your country and doing what's right and being like a soldier and almost part of like a warrior ethos, like you're adopting that, branding that into yourself and your very being, only for it to be like spit on basically by the people who are there supposed to be teaching you and helping you. It's heartbreaking. And I was just curious your thoughts on, like, do you think we're going to have a crack through with this court case? Do you think there's going to be significant change in upcoming years?
I definitely hope so. I mean, that anonymous submission from the Senate inquiry into this course that was done in 2017, it had a lot of different submissions that had very similar testimonies to this one. And it was very, very heartbreaking having to read through quite a lot of them. But this one specifically stood out to me, which is why I put it in the article. Look, I do believe that there will be a breakthrough, especially with this court case. I mean, I'm very confident that we're going to win this court case. It's a simple... Unfortunately, I was unable to, like, when I made my complaints about this course to the Australian Human Rights Commission, basically saying, well, we're suffering torture. You know, I was, you know, the subject of... my human rights were breached around, you know, religious discrimination. You know, obviously forcing someone to renounce their faith and do disgusting acts on a Bible is, you know, obviously definitely a breach of human rights. And then obviously the sexual sort of violence on this course, the only thing that I could do domestically about that was a sexual harassment case. And I thought that was pretty disgusting that we didn't have any laws in Australia regarding the domestic use of torture. But I definitely think that this is going to be a bombshell. I mean, if the court documents get released, I think that is itself going to be a bombshell. If the court documents get released, I think that would be a bombshell. Especially when it comes to the government's plea, I think that the government's plea is something that is very, very, would be a huge bombshell, because that would be the government's official response to the allegations that I'm making. And I also think that, look, I think it's pretty easy that, you know, the things that I was describing, you know, before, that easily counts as sexual harassment. I mean, I think people have won sexual harassment cases on a lot less than that. And I think that, you know, once there's been a federal court case where there has been an official hearing, you know, that there's been official ruling by a judge around the things that are going on, that sets precedence for all other soldiers to be able to also sue the government for exactly what happened to them. And I think that the government is wise enough to know that, you know, it would just be cheaper in the long run to basically just change the course rather than keep it going as it is. And I think that there will be enough public pressure around, you know, winning a court case like that, that the government will have to actually take changing this course seriously. So, yeah, I think there is hope. I think that, you know, all the different things that our organization is doing to try and build up more support for getting this course change is you know, starting to gain ground. You know, my hope is that more people will speak up and, you know, say that they support, you know, our very, very basic and very, you know, sensible reforms to this course. And I look forward to, you know, if the government will allow it, I look forward to, you know, working with the government in any capacity to try and, you know, find sensible reforms to this course.
Thank you. And are there any other prominent whistleblowers or activists currently pushing back against this course besides yourself that you'd like to recommend or name for people to look into? Is there anyone helping along with?
Yeah, sure. So there have been two whistleblowers, besides myself, there have been two other whistleblowers who have, you know, participated in this course. So one of them is Dr. Stephen Scully, who was the medical support officer that I was telling you about before. And then there was also a SAS soldier called Evan Donaldson. And he was the guy who I was talking about who was, you know, bleeding out of his anus due to the sexual things that were happening to him. So they're both whistleblowers, and they're actually both committed to supporting our, so they've both you know, confirmed that they support the Reform CAC organization and the reform sort of policies that we're putting forward. So they're both behind Reform CAC and trying to get these policies put forward. There's also Cameron Murphy, who spoke up about this course in 2005. He's now a state senator in New South Wales, and he's very supportive of trying to get this course changed. We also have a federal senator whose name's Jackie Lambie. She's very, very supportive of getting this course changed as well. And we also have different political parties that are getting on board with supporting these reforms. Unfortunately, at the moment, the only one that I have a confirmed support from is the Victorian Socialists. But, you know, they do quite a lot of good campaigning work in regards to, you know, human rights stuff. But we're also looking at not just the left, but also, you know, political parties are probably more in line with my particular political persuasion, which is more conservative parties. We're also looking at getting support from them. And I think that after this court case is finished, there's definitely a possibility that conservative political parties will get on board. And the discussions that I've had with them is basically like, well, we really want to see what happens with this federal court case and see what happens with that before we commit to supporting your policy reforms. So I think, you know, there are quite a lot of people who are supporting this course when it comes to, you know, whistleblowers like Dr. Stephen Scully and even Evan Donaldson, who were, you know, incredible people for being able to speak up about the course when they did. It was very, very brave of them to do that. And obviously all the other sort of organizations and politicians that are also supporting reforming this course as well.
All right. That sounds good. And in regards to this article that we've been discussing, what are some big takeaways you want to give for the audience that has not been brought up yet already, or anything you'd like to sum up for people?
Yeah, well, the main points that I would just the main points that I would just put forward is, look, this, and this is stuff that's already been brought up, but I think it's important just to give a dot point sort of like overview. This course uses torture techniques. These torture techniques have been recognized by the United Kingdom Supreme Court. They've been recognized by the European Union. They've been recognized by the United Nations. They've been recognized by the Republic of Ireland. You know, these are not like fringe organizations. These are governmental, international, and, you know, governmental organizations. You know, these torture techniques, the five techniques or deep interrogation, is torture. And torture, you know, it can never be justified. I think that torture can never be justified, especially by the international agreements that Australia signed up to. the course also uses dehumanization and moral injury, you know, sexual violence, forcing people to renounce their faith or do disgusting, depraved acts on, you know, the Bible or other sort of religious texts, or, you know, denigrating people for their faith. You know, I think, you know, can be justified within the context of this course, but the sexual violence can never be justified. You know, forcing people to renounce their faith can never be justified. And the use of stuff like homosexual porn, you know, sex toys, like these things are just disgusting, and no one should be subjected to such disgusting sort of acts with this sort of stuff. Another point, support staff to this course have already spoken up at that they don't feel like they can really intervene. We need support for people to be able to put mechanisms in place so that people can feel like they can actually intervene into the disgusting things that happen on this course. And I think that requires civilians and, you know, within an independent structure, being able to have it, you know, have some sort of like oversight over this course. The suicide rate is astronomically high for people who go through this course, 38 times higher than the national rate and 15 times higher than the veteran rate. That is just way too much. One suicide is too much, but this is just ridiculous. We cannot continue to allow this suicide rate to be so high for just a single course. There needs to be greater support for soldiers who have already done this course and are trying to integrate into civilian life. DVA, or the Department of Veterans Affairs, needs to support these soldiers who go through this course and actually make sure that they're, you know, taken care of. And we need the government to recognize what's going on and to actually apologize to veterans who have had to go through this. They need to change this course. And the best way, if you want to, you know, be a part of getting this course changed, especially if you're Australian, is to go to the Reform CAC website. It's www.damiendp.com/ReformCAC. Reform CAC being REFORMCAC. There are plenty of ways for you to show your support. There are different ways for you to talk to your politician or to contact your local politician about what's happening on this course, and to tell them what you feel about it, and to tell them that they need to support reform to this course. So I highly recommend, if you want to be a part of this, especially if you're Australian, that you go to the website and you know, contact your local politician to tell them that this needs to change.
And one more thing, is there any other sources that are used for those affected that they should reach out to in terms of any mental rehabilitation?
Yeah, so people who have gone through this course and need support can also go to our website. There is a forum there that you can you know, speak directly to me, and I can try and get you in touch with different ways that can help you. Obviously, there is, for any Australian soldier who's served any time in the army, you can go to Open Arms, which is a counseling service, which is free to anyone who has served in the army. But you can also take legal action. And, you know, I think that taking legal action will actually help get this course changed. But if you don't feel like you're up for a legal battle, there are plenty of other ways that we can talk and see if there are ways that you can support getting this course changed without, you know, becoming a public figure or having to go through a long legal battle.
Thank you again, Damien, for being on our show. And this definitely wasn't an easy topic to talk about, but it's honestly good to hear that you're doing God's work and pushing forward and wanting justice for what has been done.
Well, thank you for hosting me and allowing me to talk about such an important topic. It's good to continue discussing this topic, and I appreciate you you allow me to have on your podcast. Does great work, and I'm very proud to be a part of it.
Definitely. Is there anything else that we haven't mentioned or talked about or brought up that we should be discussing at all? Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. I just say that if you want more updates as to the federal court case or anything else that a Reform CAC is doing, feel free to follow me on Twitter at Damien DePyle. I will be posting updates as to all the different things that Reform CAC is doing. It's just a good way to stay informed about the good work that we're doing and what we're trying to do. So if you want some updates, feel free to follow me on Twitter.
Thank you for that, Damian, and it was a pleasure having you on our show. I honestly think we've said everything that needs to be said for now. I would love to have you on in the future for as much time as you need to give us updates in case there's anything pivotal or monumental is happening or a change. And we'll definitely be keeping an eye on this. And for any of our veterans listening in, doesn't matter where you are across the globe, we stick with each other, because that's one thing they can't take away from us, is our warrior spirit that we have that other people don't. So no matter what, even if you're Australian, I'm American, whatever, I got your back, you got mine, because that's how it is.
100% agree. We've all got each other's backs, and you know, the Australian government don't know the warrior that they've unleashed upon them with this campaign.
Well, that's all from me, folks, for Rec Room Radio. We're going to go ahead and close it out for now. That's been our episode with Damian, and glad to have him on again. It means a lot, and glad to get this issue out. If you want to follow him for more updates, like I said, his Twitter bio would be included with this episode. And any other information where you want to find him, feel free to reach out to him if it's related to this or if you want to know more. I look forward to seeing you again in the future, Damian, if we do have a part two of this when there's more updates going on and we can discuss that as well. But it means a lot for you to be on again.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.